the reason we led with Kevin Katke and his sort of weird role in the Grenada invasion, it was really emblematic of a lot of the component parts of Iran-Contra, where you had government officials, specifically Oliver North, kind of finding people outside the government, private citizens who were a little more free to do things that the government was not allowed to do. You know, they hired people to fly planes and, you know, into Nicaragua to airdrop supplies to the Contras. They hired an arms dealer to manage the resupply operation to the Contras and manage logistics for the Iran weapons sales. You know, I guess the word for this is like cutouts. They were using cutouts, people who could do things that the government didn't want its fingerprints on. And there was just like a theme running through the whole story of these sort of outsiders, freelancers, who became essential to the functioning of American foreign policy in a way that you really, you know, cuts against, I think, how a lot of us think foreign policy should work and should be executed.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 4th, 2020. Leon Neyfakh is the co-creator and former host of Slow Burn, which won the iHeartRadio Podcast Award for Podcast of the Year last year, and now the co-creator and host of Fiasco, entering its second season on Luminary. This second season deals with the Iran-Contra scandal, including some of the stories and people that you know, things like Iran, Nicaragua, Bud McFarlane, John Poindexter, and Oliver North, but also some names and things you might not remember that make the story a very rich scandal indeed. We sat down and talked to Leon Neyfakh about Slow Burn, about Fiasco, and especially about the Iran-Contra scandal. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 504, Leon Neyfakh on Iran-Contra and other scandals. Leon, we want to talk a lot today about the Iran-Contra scandal and what developed, who was involved in it, what it teaches us today. But let's go back a little bit earlier because this is not your first scandal. Why do you love digging into other people's misery that hit the headlines?
You know, I don't think of it that way. I only realized the richness of political scandal after doing the first season of Slow Burn. It was never something I really gravitated towards before. You know, I had a career as a print reporter for about, I guess, 10 years before we started Slow Burn, and I'd covered, you know, the book publishing industry, and I'd written about pop music, and I'd written about academia at the Boston Globe, and then criminal justice at Slate. So I don't know. I'd never really engaged with political scandals before making these shows, and I think what I've found I like about them is that they allow you to tell stories about individuals who are passing through history or like waltzing across the stage of history and experiencing that history in a pretty unique way. So, you know, a lot of these stories that we've rendered as podcasts, whether it's Watergate or the Clinton impeachment or Iran-Contra or the 2000 election, you know, we learn about them, we vaguely remember them as spectators. But what I found is that when you actually speak to individuals who were there, and especially individuals who didn't become like famous for what they did, so people who were, mm-hmm. you know, working as investigators for a congressional committee whose names no one really knows outside of a very narrow circle, you know, they experience this stuff with all the same human receptors and sensitivities that we, you know, experience our own lives as we move through the world. And it's the combination of that relatability and the sort of hugeness of the events that these people become part of that I think gives me sort of that sort of is what I love about it.
So you started the first season when you were co-creator and former host of Slow Burn. You started that first season just as the Trump administration was beginning. Why did you decide to narrow down on Watergate as the first story to tell?
Well, so first of all, I think we didn't really know it was the first story we were telling. We weren't imagining sequels at that point. And, you know, I think at the time when we started, which I think was around, I want to say August of 2017, like investigations were already well underway. And mm-hmm. more generally, like the feeling of chaos emanating from the White House was in full effect. And you were hearing a lot, you know, of references to Watergate on TV, you know, where people would sort of invoke it more, you know, pretty briefly as sort of an obvious reference point. And, you know, a lot of people who had roles in Watergate, like people in the Independent Counsel's office, were talking about it on television as experts. So it was in the air, you know, and I think what we wanted to do was sort of ask whether living through Watergate was similar to what it felt like to live through 2016, 2017, sort of waking up every day and not knowing what was going to happen, and looking forward to the next, you know, revelation, you know, that we were going to get to read about in the Times from the Mueller investigation. And I think that animating impulse, like what was it like to live through that scandal, that turmoil on a day-to-day basis, is what kind of led us to the recipe we ended up with.
There are so many stories within all of these.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I feel like with the subsequent seasons we've done, we've sort of inadvertently tapped into something very resonant in terms of the present. But with that first one, like, it was very deliberate. Like, we knew that Watergate was going to feel relevant. We didn't necessarily know how, or we didn't necessarily know the number of different very specific parallels that we were going to discover. But we had a feeling that it would feel relevant. And I think in the end, some part of what made the show successful was that I think people were able to listen to Slow Burn, and it informed their thinking about the present by way of a narrative that didn't use Trump's name all the time.
And it also introduced them to some people that they hadn't experienced before, because in the popular imagination, Watergate is the story of course, Richard Nixon, but it's the story of John Dean. Maybe it's the story of some of the congressional investigators. But you drilled into a personality like Martha Mitchell. And here's someone who may have kindled some memories for people who were around then, but for people who weren't, you were telling a whole new story about someone who has an outsized personality and really able to bring that story alive. What were the things that stood out to you after doing that episode on the Attorney General's wife and how it resonated with your audience?
So it's funny, like I always get a little self-conscious when people say to me, like, how did you, you know, discover Martha Mitchell? Mm-hmm. Because like, A, she was super famous at the time. I forget what the Gallup poll on her like name recognition was, but it was insane. People really treated her as a celebrity, you know, before all this stuff with Watergate happened. And so I was just fascinated by the fact that someone could be that well-known and then just fade away from popular consciousness. I think, you know, some older listeners would laugh when I treated her as like a novelty because they grew up knowing about her. But again, I always feel sheepish when people like give me credit for discovering her, because, you know, she's in all the books. If you read, you know, Anthony Lucas's Nightmare, like there's a lot of material on Martha Mitchell in there. But I think like what I realized when I think it was in reading Lucas where I first learned about her, what struck me was that she had not become attached to Watergate in a lasting way, in part because our sort of main like texts that we all reference when we think about Watergate, and I'm only mainly talking about All the President's Men, you know, didn't include her. And I was actually tickled to find that an early script of All the President's Men did include her, which made me, you know, which made me wonder if those scenes had been shot and had been included in the movie, like would Martha Mitchell have become part of the canon, you know, alongside Woodward and Bernstein, and I just don't know. But yeah, it really felt like turning over a rock and finding all this amazing material. It felt like cheating. Again, you know, again, as someone who was a print reporter writing about the present and constantly trying to like find some original angle or some little tidbit of, you know, that could be a fresh lead, it felt like cheating to go into history, read all this stuff, watch whatever documentaries already existed, and realize that I could bring this, you know, material back to life for an audience for whom it would be entirely new.
And then for the second season, you rinsed and repeat, but you took the Clinton Lewinsky story and looked at it in some different ways. For example, spending, I think, the entirety of an episode on the feminist movement, both how it split at the time over issues of how to deal with the president and those allegations, but then also the reflection in the decades since. What did you learn about the feminist movement and societal attitudes in general based on that analysis?
The big thing that struck me from doing the interviews I did for that episode was that the conventional wisdom that feminists sort of as a group, abandon Monica Lewinsky and threw her to the wolves in service of, you know, siding with a president whose policies on abortion they supported, was not all the way true. There was, in fact, a very rich and spirited debate within the feminist movement between people like Linda Hirschman, whom I interviewed, whose feeling was, whose belief was that a relationship between a president and an intern was inherently exploitative because of the power differential, and that Monica Lewinsky was a victim and that she should have been treated as one rather than as a punchline. Meanwhile, there were, on the whole, younger feminists who held the position that Monica Lewinsky may have been young, but she was also an adult and she should be free and have the autonomy to make decisions about her sex life that other people don't approve of. And that doesn't make her a victim. She, you know, entered into this affair with an understanding of what it was, and she should be allowed to do that. And I think what struck me about that debate is that 20 years later, you know, the Linda Hirschman position, which is that the power differential was so extreme that it cannot be tolerated, that is, I think, today the sort of fashionable or more progressive point of view, whereas back then I think those younger feminists saw someone like Linda Hirschman as being conservative.
Right.
And so, you know, the sort of shifting of the political or ideological valence of these two poles was really interesting to me.
What was the difference in the reactions that you got directly? I mean, obviously, Slow Burn did well. The iHeart Radio Podcast Awards last year, you won Podcast of the Year across all categories. But in terms of specific feedback directly to you, what was the difference between the response to the Watergate stories and the Whitewater / Lewinsky stories?
So I think they may have reached slightly different audiences. I'm not sure. But I think the Clinton season landed at a time when people were really thinking hard about the Me Too movement. People were quite primed to reevaluate Clinton through the prism of the Me Too movement. There was just like a real sense of, I think people came away from it maybe, I like to believe, with a sense of clarity about what exactly happened, who did what. And I think, you know, I will say that we got some reactions that were like, wow, you know, Clinton, boy, what a monster. He's no better than Trump. And that's, you know, I don't think that's what we were saying. You know, the way I always, sometimes people ask me, like, did your view of Clinton change over the course of the season? And the answer is certainly yes. I think that always happens when you learn a lot about a person. But the way I always have to answer that question is, like, are we including the Juanita Broderick allegations or are we putting them to the side? Because if you put them to the side, I think there's a lot of gray area to discuss and a lot of, you know, quite morally ambiguous things to work through. If you think he is a violent rapist, then there's not a lot to talk about. And so I think different things stayed with different listeners. I think for some people, one big takeaway was that, boy, Clinton really was pursued like a real target by these conservative forces. For other people, it was, you know, the Juanita Broderick episode really sort of just like overpowered everything else.
And now you've moved to a different kind of scandal with Fiasco Season 1, which is over and fully available on Luminary. You decided to tackle a different kind of story, which was the Florida recount of the year 2000. But you looked at it in a slightly different way than others have, who have focused solely on the legal aspects, although you clearly touch on those, or solely on the political aspects of the last few days of the campaign, although you touch on those. Talk a little bit about how the Florida recount in your mind was bigger than just those frames.
So our recurring philosophy with everything we've done, including Slow Burn and Fiasco, has been that the way to find fresh material in old stories is to try to, A, talk to people who haven't necessarily been interviewed before and put them front and center, find a way into the story that's going to feel unexpected. And so you mentioned Elian Gonzalez. Like, the series leads with this fisherman whom we interviewed who was out on the water and saw the body of a baby, of a child, and fished him out and brought him to the Coast Guard. And that gave rise to this incredibly complicated political fight between broadly right-wing Cuban exiles in Miami and the Clinton administration, which wanted to send Elian Gonzalez back to Cuba, where his father was requesting that he go.
Which really was a great framing exercise for this story because, frankly, a lot of people who lived through the 2000 debacle don't connect it to the Gonzalez story and the issues that came up there.
Well, I think what I learned doing that season is that cause and effect is a really hard thing to tease out, especially with a long, you know, campaign and a post-election recount period that includes all these moving parts. Because the point of our first episode was that, depending on how you look at it, like Florida was already lost by Gore, you know, months before anyone voted because of these mistakes he made, or because he was unable to kind of finesse the politics of Elian Gonzalez, because he had to distance himself from Clinton, and then also separately this very obscure fight over the Homestead Air Force Base, which was being redeveloped into a big airport right next to a couple of national parks, including the Everglades. Both of those stories illustrated just how little things can end up costing you everything in the end. And I think every other episode of the series kind of drove that home. Like, there was just so many forking paths over the course of that 36 days where certain rulings could have gone a certain way. You know, if the Palm Beach canvassing board hadn't adjourned for Thanksgiving, then maybe they would have had time to finish their recount and all those Gore votes they'd found would have been added to the final count. You know, maybe if the person who designed the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach had designed it differently, Gore would have won an extra 3,000 votes that otherwise went to Buchanan because people were confused by the ballot and there wouldn't have even been a recount. And so it just makes you wonder, like, you know, to take your invitation to discuss sort of the bigger ramifications of the 2000 election to go really big, it almost feels like it was an education in just how contingent life can be and how choices you make can have unexpected consequences, you know. And to bring that down to earth a little bit, I think it also was illuminating for me to see how differently the Republicans and the Democrats approached the task of trying to win the recount. There's definitely sort of tendencies and pathologies that were on display in how both sides went about combat that I think tell us quite a bit about how they're different.
Sure. The season that's dropping now on Fiasco has to do, of course, with the Iran-Contra scandal. Huge scandal at the time, and yet one mm-hmm. that doesn't necessarily resonate with people the same way as these others. And we'll get to that in a minute. But first, let me play everyone a short clip from the first episode that's about to drop on the new season of Fiasco.
Iran-Contra is a story about running with it. It's a complicated story that spans the globe. And if you've gotten through life not knowing exactly what it was all about, or what the Iran part has to do with the Contra part, or what the Contra part even refers to, you're not alone. Compared to Watergate or the Clinton-Lewinsky affair, Iran-Contra is a relatively obscure scandal. Most people just don't have a firm grasp on what happened.
So, Leon, why do you think it is that people don't have that firm handle? Why is it that Iran-Contra has proven so elusive in the decades since?
So this is something I've been trying to puzzle out since we started. I think it's like one of our animating questions for the series. Because as you said earlier, like, this was a massive, spectacular scandal when it was first unfolding. People really were tuned in. I mean, I think if I'm not mistaken, the Iran-Contra hearings actually got bigger ratings than Watergate did. But, you know, everyone knows that the summer of Watergate was this thing where everyone, you know, was glued to their TVs. And we just don't have that association with Iran-Contra, even though it was just as true. And so the question is, what happened? Like, why did that not turn into a more lasting kind of cultural impact? Why is it that if you just go to a party and ask around, what do you think happened during Iran-Contra, something I've done as part of my informal research, people will give you blank stares. Maybe they'll know the name Oliver North. Maybe they'll know that there was some kind of arms for hostages arrangement. Maybe they'll know that George H.W. Bush pardoned a bunch of the Iran-Contra defendants at the end of his presidency. But there's very few, I think, like, iconic moments or people who have really sort of persisted in the popular imagination. And I think, like, the reasons for that that I've come up with are all just theories, but one basic one is that it was just too complicated. Mm-hmm. You know, it was this sort of multi-pronged scandal. It was actually two scandals that were joined together through a hard-to-understand financial transaction. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that it happened in other countries maybe contributed to the indifference that eventually set in. Like, it's just a fact that it's harder to get people to care about foreign affairs. I think it's sort of instructive that even though allegations of drug smuggling by the Contras and varying levels of complicity by the CIA, even though all that stuff was sort of in the air and being reported and talked about and was the subject of an intensive investigation mm-hmm. by a committee headed by John Kerry in 1987, even though all that stuff was out there, it didn't really stick until 1996 when Gary Webb, this reporter whose name people will probably recognize, wrote a package for the San Jose Mercury News in which he essentially made the allegation that the Contra war and the drug smuggling that was used to fund it was directly responsible for the crack explosion in Los Angeles and in other cities in America. And I think and that just like totally became national news. Everyone, you know, everyone was reading that story. It was a total sensation. And I think actually that's what I was listing earlier, like the things people might remember about Iran-Contra if you ask them. You mm-hmm. know, it's like Oliver North, it's arms for hostages, and, oh, it's the CIA caused the crack epidemic by letting the Contras sell crack to gangs in L.A. That's like a, I would say, that's like a meme. You know, people really absorbed that one. And I think one reason why is that Gary Webb in his article made a point of connecting the wrongdoing he was reporting on in Nicaragua and Honduras to something that people could see in America, in Los Angeles and other cities. And it brought it home in a way that I think has made it resonate a lot more. So those are a couple of ideas about why, you know, it hasn't earned more of a permanent place in our cultural memory. I always use these phrases and I always wonder what they actually mean, like cultural memory. Like, I guess it just means like people don't talk about them on TV and we don't, you know, they don't come up in conversation. But one kind of maybe more interesting possibility that I'm still working through is that the Iran weapons sales, again, were their own thing, right? We were doing that for certain reasons mm-hmm. that we get into, obviously, in the show. And the Contra war was something we were involved in for totally separate reasons. And then there's this hyphen, or depending on who you ask, this endash in the middle of Iran-Contra that connects them. And the way in which they're connected is not intuitive at all. You know, it's not like Oliver North and the NSC initiated the weapon sales in order to fund the Contras. It was not that mm-hmm. simple. Like, the diversion of funds was sort of an act of circumstance. Like, they realized they could once that money was coming in by way of the arms sales. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I'm naive to think that it was not as premeditated as all that. But I think it's just the focus on the hyphen was so intense. Like, did Reagan know about the diversion of funds? That became the question during the 1987 hearings. And I think once Reagan was cleared of that by John Poindexter, his national security advisor, who told Congress that he approved the diversion of funds and did not tell Reagan about it on purpose mm-hmm. so that he would have deniability, once that kind of shoe dropped, that was sort of it. Like, there was a mystery. Did Reagan know about the diversion? And then the mystery was effectively put to rest. And amazingly, Oliver North in his memoir writes about how, to him, he was watching all this and he was like, wow, they've really focused in on this diversion thing, but there's at the expense of caring about either of the things on either side of the hyphen. Like, they don't seem as obsessed with, you know, did Reagan approve the arms shipments? Did Reagan approve the illegal, you know, funding of the Contras? They're really just obsessed with this diversion. And I kind of think that focus ended up sort of sapping the story of a lot of importance, because it sort of made it easier for people to just put it away as a settled matter when, sure. I don't know, the two things that they were doing that they ended up connecting through this financial transaction that we now know of as the diversion, those were the right things to process and evaluate, more so than this pretty tangential question of whether Reagan specifically knew about the diversion of funds. Does that make sense?
It does. I think the podcast, which I've been able to listen to much of already, you have the big and the small themes. So you have the big themes about, You know, what is the role of an entity like the National Security Council staff when agencies are prohibited from doing something? What is the role of the office immediately around the president? But you also go to these small personal themes. I'll tell you, my personal experience, my memories of Iran-Contra have literally never connected to the story about crack in L.A. Never happened. For me, I remember being young and my parents saying, this is history on television, we're watching this, and going out and buying dozens of VHS tapes and literally recording every hour of the hearings to save them for posterity. The images that I remember are Oliver North testifying. I remember Fawn Hall testifying and her 80s haircut. I remember her talking about taking stacks of documents and feeding them into the shredder so much that they were actually breaking the shredders doing it. I remember the attorney, Brendan Sullivan, saying at one point when questions are not being addressed to him or being he's not being consulted with about what his client should or shouldn't be allowed to say, him saying, I'm not a potted plant. Those things stand out in my imagination, even though even then I was a political foreign affairs junkie and I should have been caring about what is United States policy towards Iran. What does this have to do with this civil war inside Nicaragua and running across Central America? But it was those images, those people that really connect. So I found it telling that you begin the tale with one of those stories. You talk about a name that, frankly, I had forgotten in the Iran-Contra affair. You talk about Kevin Katke. Who was Kevin Katke, and why is he important to the Iran-Contra story?
So Kevin Katke was someone we first read about in a New York Magazine story that was published in 87. He was a maintenance engineer at a Macy's in Bayshore, Long Island. He was just a guy, and he was really into foreign policy. He cared a lot about the cause of anti-communism. He really wanted to, he was a patriot, self-described patriot. He wanted to help his country. He got interested in the situation in Jamaica, and went down there a bunch with, you know, three of his friends from town to meet with, you know, right-wing dissidents there and try to help them and try to bring back intelligence to the U.S. And, you know, I think they would, like, call the CIA and try to get them to listen to their findings. And obviously these randos, like, didn't get a lot of airtime when they were doing that. And then his next thing, like, after Jamaica elected a right-wing prime minister and no longer needed Kevin's help... I'm stealing now a line from the show. Apologies.
I think you can steal from your own show.
Once that happened, he moved on to this tiny Caribbean island of Grenada, which was at the time, which had in 1979 had been taken over by revolutionaries, Marxist revolutionaries, and he started cultivating, you know, contacts with Grenadian dissidents who were a lot of whom were living in New York, and sort of trying to organize a resistance, you know, an exile movement from his, you know, from his home in Bayshore. He met a lawyer who had moved to the U.S. from Grenada as an exile, and whom Kevin wanted to elevate as a leader in the anti-communist movement in Grenada. And he let that guy live on a boat that he had docked behind his house. It was all very human scale, and so it was. He started taking that guy down to Washington. So this Grenadian lawyer, Michael Sylvester, Kevin started bringing him down to Washington and trying to meet with people in the government. I think he met with someone in Jesse Helms' office. There were a couple other people that actually gave him the time of day. He ended up getting connected to this guy who was then with the CIA, but by 1983 was with the National Security Council. And as it happened, like, Reagan too was very interested in Grenada and worried that communist government in Grenada would end up being part of what he called a red triangle in Central America with Nicaragua and Cuba. And so it turned out that Kevin's, you know, contacts in the Grenadian exile community would be quite useful to the Reagan administration. And through, you know, circumstances I won't get into now because I'm already giving you too long an answer here, they ended up calling on Kevin Katke to help them. Oliver North personally called him and said, look, here's what I need you to do. And he gave him a bunch of tasks that were sort of, you know, things he didn't want, I guess, the government to have their fingerprints on. And Kevin tried to do them. He mostly failed. And, you know, the U.S. invaded Grenada in 1983. And it was sort of an incredibly important moment because it broke the seal or broke the fever on what was called the Vietnam syndrome, where Americans just didn't have any appetite for foreign intervention, while people like Reagan and Oliver North felt really strongly that anti-communism was still a top priority. By invading Grenada successfully and sort of showing that they could oust, you know, a communist government, the Reagan administration was able to show that this was something we should be doing. And I think it led to – it emboldened them, I think, eventually in terms of Nicaragua.
Right.
Anyway, the reason we led with this, the reason we led with Kevin Katke and his sort of weird role in the Grenada invasion, it was really emblematic of a lot of the component parts of Iran-Contra, where you had government officials, specifically Oliver North, kind of finding people outside the government, private citizens who were a little more free to do things that the government was not allowed to do. You know, they hired people to fly planes and, you know, into Nicaragua to airdrop supplies to the Contras. They hired an arms dealer to manage the resupply operation to the Contras and manage logistics for the Iran weapons sales. You know, I guess the word for this is like cutouts. They were using cutouts, mm-hmm. people who could do things that they that the government didn't want its fingerprints on. And there was just like a theme running through the whole story of these sort of outsiders, freelancers, who became essential to the functioning of American foreign policy in a way that you really, you know, cuts against, I think, how a lot of us think foreign policy should work and should be executed. So that's Kevin Katke. That's why we led with him.
You didn't just deal with individuals like that who happened to be working at Macy's but were somehow right. related to this. You got up to and including people like the national security advisors in the Reagan administration. I want to play one more clip from your show to tee up this next question about some of them.
It has shown Americans in dramatic fashion that the government, at the end of the day, is really just a bunch of people. The fact that they've been temporarily put in charge of institutions that are much bigger than them doesn't change that. If anything, it reinforces the need to understand them as individuals, men and women who act on their obsessions, their ambitions, and their delusions.
So, Leon, talking about those people put in charge of institutions, one of the most memorable, almost emotional moments so far in Fiasco Season 2 is when you're talking to Robert Bud McFarlane, who was the national security advisor who was at the center of Iran-Contra in many ways, even though his successor, John Poindexter, ended up seeing a lot of it through. But talk about your sessions interviewing Bud McFarlane and how he ended up striking you in terms of his reflections on his role and how he sees what he did now.
So we spoke to Bud McFarlane on three separate occasions. He was initially quite reluctant to sit down with us. I think he would really love for this to not be his legacy. He would love for this to not be the first thing people think of when they hear his name. For context, Bud McFarlane was sort of the one who brought the idea of selling weapons to Iran as a way of possibly getting some hostages back and mm-hmm. more broadly making inroads with moderates in the Iranian government who could potentially be helpful down the line in a post-Khomeini world. It was, you know, it was his initiative that resulted in Reagan approving the first arms sales to Iran. But by the time, you know, a couple of those shipments had gone through and nothing had really gone right, McFarlane really turned on the idea. And he had always been skeptical of it, I think, but he really became convinced that it was a really, really, really dangerous path to go down. And he tried to stop it. He, you know, told the president that he believed that it was going to lead to embarrassment and tried to stop the thing that he had arguably started. And then he quit. He resigned from the National Security Council in late 85, and he really regrets that decision. That was the main thing I took away from our session, was that he feels as though he was the only one who could have stopped Reagan from pursuing the arms for hostages deals. He says he understood that Reagan was really fixated on the hostages, that he really wanted them to be freed, and his sort of emotional attachment to that goal kind of clouded his judgment when it came to bigger picture, you know, risk analysis.
And that is one of the things, Leon, that really jumps out from this season is listening to it is very clearly from all the people you talk to, Ronald Reagan wasn't making these decisions for personal gain. As scandalous as they ended up becoming, it wasn't Ronald Reagan looking to the next election to get an advantage. It largely was a story of Ronald Reagan personally sympathizing with people, hearing the stories from the hostages that had been taken and saying, we've got to find some way of getting them out, and latching on to what increasingly became a moving goalpost scenario of sending arms to the Iranians, hoping that moderates were going to make some benefit of that and release some hostages. Mm-hmm. But it ended up just becoming this thing with its own momentum that he couldn't let go of because of that personal connection to the people who had been captured.
Yeah, and you know, we spoke to people, including Jane Mayer and Doyle McManus, journalists who wrote an amazing book about the Reagan administration during Iran-Contra called Landslide. And Jane Mayer made, you know, emphasized that this was always sort of Reagan's weakness, was that he was very easily swayed by, you know, individual stories of suffering, or, you know, if there was someone in front of him who looked pitiful, he would want to help them, even though, like, many of his domestic policies surely resulted in suffering he couldn't see. He was susceptible to the sort of, like, sad story of someone's plight, and I think the hostages really brought that out in him. In fact, during the first term, when those hostages were already taken, many of his aides who knew him best, like, tried very hard to keep him away from the hostage families, mm-hmm. who were trying to get his attention and his help getting their family members home. His aides knew that, like, as soon as Reagan engaged with them, like, he would become obsessed, and sure enough, he did. And so I think for McFarlane, like, the grave error he wishes he could undo is that he left the administration when he did.
Right.
He says, right. I should have known that he would continue. I should have known there was no one else in the administration who could stop him. I could have stopped him, and I didn't, and I failed my country.
Yeah.
And he got really emotional about it. I mean, mm-hmm. he's gotten emotional about it before. Incredibly, I came across a Saturday Night Live clip where the joke is that McFarlane is testifying before Congress, and he just keeps bursting into tears, and he keeps talking about how it's all his fault. And the congressmen are like, don't worry, Mr. McFarlane, like, you've done plenty of good things in your life. And I was just, like, so shocked to find that that was enough of a, like...
enough of a meme then that they could mock it. Sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And to me, you know, and so I think this has just been with him forever. And, you know, I think it's hard for him because he's doing all this current work that he's really invested in. Actually, one of the interviews we did with him was focused exclusively on his current work, which centers on thwarting the efforts of Russia and China to build nuclear power plants in the developing world, mm-hmm. which he sees as, like, a new Cold War, basically, that America has just, like, abdicated from. And so we talked a lot about that, and there's obviously a lot of themes that connect his, you know, his geopolitical ambitions during Iran-Contra, or during his service in the Reagan administration, and this thing he's doing now. And I think he wants the work he's doing now to be untarnished by his past. And I think it's just a difficult thing for him to face, that, you know, people like me are still going to call him mm-hmm. and ask him to relive it again and again and again.
Right. Let's draw a contrast in personalities here. I had the chance to interview Ronald Reagan's many national security advisors for my first book
right.
about the president's use of intelligence. And I certainly got a strong contrast in the interviews I had between the personalities, the approach, the talking about the past from Bud McFarlane and then from John Poindexter, whom I believe you also spoke with. How did you find the contrast mm-hmm. between those two men who are so central to this story?
Yeah, boy, they're so different, Bud McFarlane and John Poindexter. Poindexter, of course, was McFarlane's deputy and then replaced him after McFarlane resigned. And he just stands behind everything 100%.
Right.
I think his only regret when I asked him about it was that they didn't have a better media strategy, you know, in place ahead of time for when everything blew out into the open. He says, mm-hmm. I wish we'd thought about how we were going to message this, because I think because he thinks the messaging is where it all went wrong.
Yeah, convinced that things were on the up and up and legal, correct?
Yeah, he feels as though farming out the Contra aid operation to the NSC was exactly what the law invited them to do, because the Bolin Amendment had specified that only intelligence agencies were barred from doing this. And the NSC, as everybody knows, is not an intelligence agency.
Hmm.
It's obviously a loophole, but I think for him, he doesn't think of it as having taken advantage of a loophole. He's just very unapologetic is, like, not even the right word. He's fully confident that they did the right things and that there would have been good results if they'd been allowed to continue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I guess I don't know about that second part. I don't remember him specifically saying that, you know, they could have achieved their big geopolitical goals of opening to Iran if they'd been allowed to continue. But I that's the feeling I got.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he has real, I think, contempt for Democrats. John Poindexter does. He feels as though, you know, this was all, like, the entire scandal was just the politicization of policy differences, that this was just Democrats trying to take Reagan down. They finally found something with which they could do it. He believes that the motivations behind the arms sales, as he understood them, which is to say, you know, this was part of a broader, again, strategic opening to Iran, where we were imagining a post-Khomeini world, and we needed to make sure that U.S. had influence in Iran so that the Soviet Union couldn't gain influence in Iran. He thinks that's all legit and still stands by it. Mm-hmm. And I think, and one thing I asked him was like, well, does it bother you that like Reagan clearly didn't care that much about that stuff and was obviously just interested in the hostages? And he was like, yeah, I mean, I'll concede that he was more interested in the short-term goals, which is to say the release of the hostages. But no, that doesn't change my assessment of the program.
Yeah. Well, I will tell our listeners that you want to be listeners of Fiasco. Season 2 is just starting now. Leon, what's next? You're going to wrap up with Iran-Contra soon. Then what? Benghazi? Ukraine? What are you looking at in terms of the next scandal?
I thought about Benghazi, actually. I think Benghazi would be really interesting. Mm-hmm. But I think, no, so we do have a third season already in production, mm-hmm. But I'm not supposed to say what it's about yet. Apologies. But it's going to be, it's a different kind of story. It's more of a social history of,
okay.
I'm not even sure how to describe it yet, but it's different. It's not about a scandal. it's not about a localized
branching
presidential
out.
Scandal.
Branching out completely.
Yeah. And then we're looking ahead to the fourth season already, and what we want to do for that one, and I'm saying this in case anyone who's listening to this has any good ideas and wants to tell me, we want to focus on a person. We want to like find someone to interview at length, you know, about an experience they had, about, you know, something they lived through, where they were one of these people who, you know, found themselves on the stage of history. It doesn't have to be a person who was at the center of a scandal either. It just we want to find a person who to sort of profile in the Fiasco / slow burn style, you know, and. If we can do that, I think we could push past the sort of formula I think that we've settled on so far with the shows we've made, and take it in a different direction. So if you can think of a person who could sustain 6 to 8 episodes of podcast, I'm all ears.
I've got some ideas we'll talk about afterward. Leon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was so fun.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Leon Nafok for coming on the show. Please do tweet about the podcast. Put it out there on Facebook. Put it out there on any social media. You know what? Forget social media. Actually talk to people. Tell them about the Lawfare Podcast. And if you have any interest in the scandals that presage the ones that we're going through now, talk a little bit about this episode in particular and get some love for the Iran-Contra scandal. This episode was edited and produced by Jen Patya-Howell. Jacob Schultz was our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.